UK Wine Show, show number 94. Greg Jones on climate change. On this week's show...
If we know that Pinot Noir has a narrow climate that it can do well in, then what does that look like? Not only today, but what are our climate models projecting that in the future?
And in the news this week, British Medical Journal advocates smaller wine bottles, Blossom Hill branches out, and Italians agree name for Tokaj.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 94 for the 7th of February 2008. My name is Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with climatologist Greg Jones. Greg's family own a vineyard in Oregon, and we talk with Greg about the big picture on climate change and what it means for the wine industry. But before we get into the sunny weather of climate change, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. The British Medical Journal is challenging the size of the traditional wine bottle in a bid to help cut alcohol consumption and related health problems. They're suggesting producers offer wine in smaller 50 centilitre bottles which can be shared between two people. The deputy editor, Dr. Trish Groves, argues once you both have a glass, it's all too tempting to finish the bottle rather than waste it. And with wine getting stronger in alcohol, she says it's no wonder Britain's middle-aged, middle classes are getting wasted. The message is timely since Waitrose is this week launching Vin à Deux, a range of 8 wines in 50 centilitre bottles, which the supermarkets say is a comfortable size for two people to share and caters for responsible drinking habits of the future. Waitrose say that drinking à deux will dispense with unfinished bottles of wine or feeling the need to finish off a full bottle. The new range, with bottles costing from £3.99 to £6.99, joins Waitrose's 25 centilitre solo glass format wine. Next up, Californian wine brand Blossom Hill is branching out with the launch of a range of wines from Italy, Chile and South Africa. The new selection is priced slightly higher than the main Californian range at £5.49 to £5.99. Blossom Hill say their consumers are keen to explore new wine regions but often lack the confidence to try new wines. The launch will let them experiment but with the reassurance of a well-known and trusted brand. They've also launched a website for consumers at www.blossomhill.com, which includes tasting guides, hints and tips on drinking responsibly, and a section on recycling and how consumers can work with the brand to reduce its impact on the environment. And finally this week, the Italians have resolved the fiasco of what to call the wine that used to go by the name of Tokaj. After much disagreement and court hearings, the Italian government has declared that when the DOC wines are sold in Italy, they'll be labelled either Tokaj Frullano or just Frullano. For export markets, they must be labelled only as Frullano. However, this isn't the end of the story because the European court still has to make a decision. And this probably won't happen until autumn 2008. In the meantime, though, the Italian government's decision will be valid and the 2007 vintage will at least have a name. That's all for now, but don't forget you can read these stories in full on our website 3050.co.uk. Just click on podcast and go to the news.
Cheers, Jane. Well, poor old Dr. Trish Groves. There's a number of ways of preserving wine, such as vacuum vins or putting an inert gas over the wine, so you don't need to drink that whole bottle in one go. In our house, we often have multiple bottles of wine open, and I don't feel the need to finish the wine. But I accept that some people do feel they need to, and a 50 centilitre bottle might be appropriate for them. That's assuming they just don't drink two of them. On the downside, the wine will not store as well as a 750ml bottle. The amount of oxygen leaking in through the cork versus the amount of wine to absorb it is a much worse situation, so the wine won't preserve as long. Also, the small size will increase the waste per centilitre of wine, and the storage and shipping costs will effectively go up as well. That said, I do like sherry in a 375ml bottle. I'm the only one who drinks it in my house, and it usually takes me a couple of days to get through a wee bottle like that. So different formats are a good idea. Jane summed it up earlier when we were talking about this, when she said that with most consumer goods, you think about the consumption and then design the packaging accordingly. And maybe a 750ml bottle is a bit of a throwback to the dark ages where we didn't really think about that. Maybe we do need to get a bit more sophisticated in our packaging of wine. If you remember, we spoke to Phil Laffer a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned in the interview that he thought the US could water down their wines. I got an email from Amy Christine. She's in her second year of study for her Master's of Wine. She says, I listened to the interview with Phil Laffer, but have to correct him on a small detail. We cannot water back wine in the US. It is illegal, not because of any concern over quality, but because of taxes. Federal tax law states the following. For wineries that produce under 100,000 gallons of wine, taxes on wine under 14% alcohol are 0.17 cents a gallon. For over 14% alcohol, the tax is 0.67 a gallon. Seemingly, it's called the small producer's credit. For wineries producing over 100,000 gallons that are under 14% ABV, taxes are $1.07 a gallon, and over 14% ABV, it skyrockets to $1.57 a gallon. According to her, the US government isn't about to let anyone water back overripe grapes. They'd lose a tremendous amount of money. But all that said, according to her, she knows several producers who water back every vintage, and for the same reason that Phil Laffer was stating. It's very difficult for them to achieve phenolic maturity, or flavour maturity, without excessive sugar levels. Still, according to her, it isn't legal, which is a total bummer, according to Amy. Cheers, Amy, for sorting that out. As you'll hear over the next couple of weeks, there's quite a bit people can do to manage climate change with respect to wines and vines, and it's not all doom and gloom. Sure, there's going to be some winners and losers, but the losers are the people who don't want to know about it. And if you stay up with things, most of the world's wine regions will be fine. And some countries are going to do really, really well, such as Chile. Chile is also a big supplier of fair trade wines, and we're currently in fair trade fortnight in the UK, so I thought this month's poll would be most adept. The question is, fair trade wine is being made in Chile, Argentina and South Africa. If it was available alongside other wines, would you buy it? And the options are, I already buy fair trade wines as well as regular wines. If I had a choice, I'd buy it, but I haven't seen any fair trade wines. I don't often buy fair trade products, or I don't believe in fair trade. Do go to our website, ukwineshow.co.uk, and have your say. There's the question box on the right-hand side. As I said, Chile's a big winner of global warming, and Argentina's going to get do well as well. South Africa, possibly not so well. To find out more, we talk with Greg Jones, Professor of Climatology at the University of Southern Oregon in the USA. His research interests include areas such as climatology, hydrology, agriculture, phenology, and climate change. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Greg Jones. You're a Professor of Climatology at the University of Oregon in the USA. How are you?
I'm doing very fine.
Excellent. We're going to be talking about climate change and viticulture because you've actually got some relationships to vines. Your family grow grapes.
Yes. I've been studying climatology for quite a few years, but about the time when I started studying climatology, my father was very interested in getting into growing grapes and making wine. And so I took my time when I was studying climate and terroir to both be better versed at my academics, but also to help my family find the right land and the right climate to grow the varieties we wanted to grow.
When you're looking and talking with them about your site selection, did you think about global warming at the time?
We thought we really wanted to look for the best place that we could grow the grapes we wanted to grow in a balanced climate that had the potential to deal with climate variability and change.
Okay, and you landed up in Oregon,
We ended up in Oregon.
For those who don't know where that is,
it's in between California and Washington on the west coast of the United States. And we ended up in a kind of a moderate grape-growing region. It's not as hot as California, but it's also not as cold as some of the more coastal locations in Oregon or in Washington. And we're able to ripen a broad range of varieties, but do it in a moderate high climate without very many heat extremes and a low risk of frost or winter freeze.
We're at the Climate Change Conference in Barcelona, And one of the things you just said was quite often in the media, you get a person who's pro and anti global warming. Do you want to just comment?
Well, the comment I made in the session was really all about what happens in the media typically. When I'm dealing with people at major magazines or newspapers, they will typically write an article that will have one climatologist who is clearly believing that climate change is an issue and that humans are somewhat responsible for it. And then they do another interview with another climatologist who's what some people will call a naysayer, that they just don't believe that the human role is very significant. The problem with that is that in the entire world, it's probably 95% of climatologists or geoscientists believe that we really have a human-based problem here, and only 5% that don't. And so when the media does it a 50-50, it often looks to the public like the science is split, and that's not the case.
Okay. Do you want to just touch on the carbon cycle from carbon being released either through volcanoes or wherever the release is, and how it just cycles through?
Well, I guess the thing to really talk about is in terms of our structural atmosphere, we have carbon dioxide that exists in the atmosphere naturally, and our atmosphere is developed to be in the balance of having a small carbon dioxide, what's called a variable gas element in our atmosphere. It comes from largely outgassing of volcanoes, the burning of vegetation, and other processes that go on at the surface. And so our balanced greenhouse effect, which is very, very natural, exists as a balance of these gases that have occurred over time. But what's happened is that human use of fossil fuels, desertification, deforestation, and urbanization have all contributed to the enhancement of this overall greenhouse effect. We've added more CO2 in the atmosphere. We've added more nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. We've added more methane. And all of that acts to enhance the greenhouse, takes it from one equilibrium of keeping the planet to a certain temperature and moves it to a warmer equilibrium because of the added influence.
Will we move to another equilibrium?
Well, we already have, to tell you the honest truth. If you look at essentially since about 1750, the Industrial Revolution, and it's pretty clear that there's been a higher concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we're seeing more and more evidence of that being a very clear human component of climate change. I think what a lot of people are very, very afraid of right now is that where are we relative to maybe some abrupt climate change? I know that it's kind of Hollywood-esque sometimes, when we see a movie like The Day After Tomorrow, where we're in a 2-hour movie, you end up seeing, 400 years of climate change. And that's not the way we would expect things to happen. But we do kind of foresee that there's a potential that humans can be pushing the planet over an equilibrium brink, and we've already warmed up, and it's possible that we could warm up even more.
How much carbon is naturally emitted into the atmosphere without human evolution? So, what percentage of human CO2 emissions compared to the normal CO2?
Well, that's kind of a good question. I'm not sure I have that number. I think I've read in different places that we have essentially, from about the 1700s, we've doubled the concentration that used to be in the atmosphere back at that time, and that we are potentially headed by 2100 to doubling it again. So essentially what we're doing is that we have really, truly enhanced that amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere just through the use of fossil fuels.
Volcanoes, you get a big volcano, it's going to pump a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. And then the atmosphere recovers. So if we manage to get our carbon emissions under control, will the atmosphere recover back to its previous equilibrium?
Well, and first of all, let me kind of fix the issue on the volcanoes. Volcanoes emit all kinds of particulate matter, and they emit some CO2, but the biggest thing they emit is actually aerosols that go into the atmosphere and cause the climate to actually cool because they reflect energy from the sun away. And so volcanoes, if we had a very large volcano go off in the next day or two, climates would cool over a short period of time.
But then the CO2 is in the atmosphere, so over the longer term.
Yeah, and so the real issue here is that what's the balance of that? Volcanoes tend to be a short-term type of a response, and that typically goes away after a year or two or three. The carbon dioxide issue, though, however, is something that's a little bit more long-lived. we think that where we are today in terms of a carbon fossil fuel use issue, that we've already emitted enough CO2 that climates will continue to change for the next 50 to 100 years, even if we quit using fossil fuels today.
Getting back to the grape situation, have you thought about the preventive measures that you and you might use with your father's vineyard?
Well, basically what I think it comes down to is for every operation, whether it be in one agricultural sector or another, or tourism or whatever it may be, we all need to look at being better stewards of kind of what we do energy-wise. Small amounts of savings, while they may not seem a lot, add up when a lot of people do it. And for the growing grapes and making wine sector, it's all about increasing the sink or the amount of carbon that is stored within your vineyard operation versus taking away the carbon dioxide that is released from your winery production, which is basically happens through fermentation. So it's all about being better stewards at storing carbon through your vines, your inner row plantings of grasses, wetlands around your vineyards, things like that. And then also capturing CO2 from fermentation, reducing CO2 use in packaging and that type of issue, and trying to come to some equilibrium of a near carbon zero kind of business. It's very hard to go completely carbon free in our fossil-based fuel, economy. But even if you come close, you can always buy offsets of planting trees somewhere else.
Oh, I hate that.
I hate that feeling, but...
No, I mean, I hate planting trees because the payback is so long that there's no guarantee of stewardship.
Well,
and
then that's
true.
Of the CO2. And what I think we're seeing a lot of right now is that there's a lot of large organizations. A lot of them are conservation groups that are buying up lands that we can plant to and be assured that those plantings will have in perpetuity a long lifespan.
Assuming no forest fires.
Yeah, assuming no forest fires. Yeah, and so it's a real challenge. But offsetting our carbon that way is about the best way we can get from close to being carbon zero to actually carbon zero.
I like giving fluorescent bulbs to the third world.
Yes, yes.
I think that makes to me that's...
To tell you the truth, using fluorescent bulbs everywhere makes a lot of sense. There's been stumbling blocks with that because the availability and cost is an issue. And so the more we can make them available and make them available at low cost, then we'll do better.
In your presentation, you did a presentation with Hans, which we'll release the podcast for that later on. There was some discussion about CO2 release from within the vines. As the soil organic material breaks down, it releases CO2. And that was controlled a wee bit by the amount of water. If you're taking vine cuttings and mulching them up and putting them back between the rows, are you just not delaying the release of CO2?
Well, you are to some degree. What you're trying to do is you're trying to keep the system somewhat in an active breakdown and storage and breakdown and storage. And the better that you can do that within an environment of putting your cuttings back in, even your seeds and skins from pressing, all of those things as they go back into the vineyard make for a better system. But it really is a large amount about maintaining a good soil structure and a good horizon. And even though we grow grapes in some very dry places in the world, there's still a lot of carbon that can be stored in the soil system and not lost through direct respiration.
I've done some interviews with various people on sustainability, biodynamics, and those guys are really into getting organic matter into the soil and getting good humus, they call it. Do you think that sort of thing is a good thing from a carbon point of view?
I think from a carbon point of view, it's very important. The challenge with growing grapes, however, though, is that you do not want an overly fertile soil. An overly fertile soil will give the grapes too much nutrients, and then they have a tendency to produce inferior fruit. They produce more vegetation and inferior fruit. So what you want to do is you want to have a balance of a good organic matter in the upper layer, maybe a nitrogen-fixing organic matter, but not overly fertile in terms of what it creates. That way you can know you can produce a pretty good crop.
You've been researching the effects of climatology and also phenolics, flavors and wines.
Flavors and plant growth.
What sort of things have you come up with in terms of
suitability for grape varieties, and also maybe how flavors might change with climate change?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that come into play with this. The basics are is that we know that climate is a structural limitation for growing any variety. Mm-hmm. You cannot grow Pinot Noir everywhere you grow Cabernet Sauvignon. We know that that exists. And so what we've typically been doing is trying to look at, through climate change assessments, if we know that Pinot Noir has a narrow climate that it can do well in, then what does that look like not only today, but what are our climate models projecting that in the future? And it basically shows us that the suitability windows for virtually all varieties are shifting. They're shifting mostly more toward the poles and higher up in elevation. Now, all that being said, that's shifting suitability zones, but there are issues related to existing varietals being grown in existing regions. Phenolic compounds, alcohol structure, acidity structures, all of those things have been changing pretty dramatically. Wines today made in virtually every region in the world are higher in alcohol, less acidic, and typically lower in pH than we've had for a long, long time. And what we're seeing is we're just seeing a different wine style coming out of grapes being grown in climates that are not as balanced as they used to be in terms of production.
Do you think that means that some regions will need to change their grape varieties?
Well, of course it will. I mean, I go back to this is a pretty simple thing. Your forebears and mine, when they had to deal with growing a crop anywhere to live, if they couldn't do it because of a drought or they couldn't do it because it got too hot or too cold, what did they do? They moved. They migrated somewhere else. That has been the response of humans for hundreds of thousands of years. And so the issue that we have today is based upon this issue of, are we so static in everything we do growing-wise that we can't see that migration is a human necessity? And if we sit there, it's almost arrogant, if you think about it, for us to say that we should always be able to grow Pinot Noir in Burgundy. Because we know that that's not the case, that climates change, that people change, people migrate. But yet our social and economic systems today, with all the infrastructure development that we put into it, becomes a real issue in terms of how we culturally look at adaptation versus the variety being adapted to. What most people are doing is instead of moving somewhere else, we're going into the winery or into the vineyard and we're tweaking it. We're tweaking the fruit or we're tweaking the wine to make up for the fact it's being grown in an unbalanced climate.
One of the slogans for wines of South Africa is biodiversity.
Yeah.
And some speakers are talking about the reduction of biodiversity because of climate change. And then in the same breath, they're almost talking about the migration of pests associated with climate.
Sure.
Why does biodiversity just not shift along the same lines as the pests?
Well, it does if there's available land.
So why are people worried about the loss of biodiversity? Is it not just that biodiversity will just move?
Well, you got to think about where you're talking about. South Africa, remember, only goes to about 34 degrees south latitude, and then there's no more land.
Yeah, so nothing's coming up.
Yeah, and so
there's going to be, to me, it's islanding. You get islanding because of humans cutting
exactly.
them off.
Yeah, and this has happened all over the world. In the western part of the United States, after the Ice Age period went away, we had islands that were created by the mountaintops all throughout the western U.S., where remnant species of both animals and plants existed only at the highest elevations because that was where the climate was most conducive. Now, the issue with South Africa is that if it continually warms, that Cape Floral biodiversity province will have to constrict in size. And once it constricts so far, it can't go up very much higher because you're basically running into the coastline.
Why can't it be reintroduced into other climates that are more suitable?
Well, maybe it could, but you know, think about the Cape Floral province developed over millions of years. Could we introduce that somewhere else? In the southern hemisphere, there's largely no place that it could go that would be the same type of climatic biogeographical region. So there's an issue with that. In parts of the northern hemisphere, yes, there are, species can shift a little bit, but can they shift fast enough to move with the changing climate? That's an interesting question. The issue with pests and diseases are that most pests and diseases have a human vehicle, we move them around. We move them around through our ornamental plants. We move them around through our foodstuffs. We move them around in the mud in our cars. So we have a tendency to help them move.
Phylloxera is a classic one where vine equipment just shifts it around from region to region.
So we have real issues with that. We're natural vegetation like the Cape Floral province. We don't expect it to be able to move unless we move it. And then where are we going to move it to? That's the big question.
Sure. What sort of pests and diseases do you think we'll be moving around?
Well, it just depends on...
Vine related.
It just depends on where you are. If we have higher moisture environments in the atmosphere, which if the atmosphere warms, we're expected to have more moisture in the air. And so higher humidity levels will induce different pressures of mildew, or rot, which is very problematic. We can also have other bugs like small bug, the Asian ladybird bug, which has been introduced to help combat some issues, has become problematic with others. Esca, the glassy-winged sharpshooter in the western United States, this is all climate-driven potential.
That produces Pierce's disease.
Yeah, that produces Pierce's disease, and it's typically been limited by climate. But as climates have become more conducive, it's become more easily spread through human movement of material.
What does Pierce's disease do to the vine?
The sharpshooter itself is a very small aphid-like organism, carries from native plants a bacteria. It's called Xylia fastodia. And that bacterium lives on the mandibles of the sharpshooter when it bites into like a native plant. And then when it goes to a grapevine, when it bites into the grapevine, all it's trying to do is get a little bit of water. But when it does that, it passes the bacterium into the grapevine. And this bacterium happens to get in the xylem structure of the vine, and it shuts down the water flow potential.
What's xylem structure?
That's where the water is flowing up and down.
The internal pipes.
Yeah, internal pipes. And what happens is that you get in that situation, you end up having the plant, if the bacteria proliferates enough, then it'll shut down water movement in the plant and it'll kill everything up above off.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I've heard about it, but I didn't know the mechanism for it. Okay. All right, Greg, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Cheers. Cheers.
The comments Greg had on CO2 levels changing to another equilibrium, I quite liked. I suppose it's a bit like a weir in a stream. The water flows in the stream and over the weir. If the water levels increase in the stream, the stream level rises, and the water flowing over the weir also increases. A new equilibrium is reached, but this time with a higher flow rate and higher water levels. I suppose climate is probably very similar. If you increase the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere, the level of CO2 in the atmosphere increases, but the flow of CO2 out also increases through plants and sea absorption from more CO2. How much the absorption of CO2 increases, and therefore how much the total level of CO2 in the atmosphere will increase, I'm not sure, but I think the mechanism is something along those lines. Next week, we're going to be talking with Professor Hans Schultz from the Department of Viticulture in Geisenheim Research Institute from Germany. Hans was one of the first scientists to research the impact of climate change on viticulture, so we'll get stuck into that next week. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.